We're doomed, we're saved.
The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts, Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. We're doomed, we're saved. Easy, I don't even know which episode we're at. Roughly 30-something?
I think it's 28.
28, so we're getting closer to 30. This time around, we'll talk about science communication, which is pretty interesting for the two of us, because you come from the side of science, and at the same time, you're a storyteller. And myself, I spent all my life in communications, in radio, journalism, and consulting when it comes to communications. And therefore, I think this is pretty, one, unscripted, so we'll see where this goes, and two, it's very fascinating because we both are convinced, I think, that we need a lot of storytelling. We need a lot of science communication to make the complex more digestible. As always, you brought quotes from pretty famous people.
I did, but I first also want to add to our great list of achievements that we are both unpublished novelists.
Oh, that's true. That's true. My novels are in the drawer.
Mine are in the email outbox to agents.
So I stick to writing pop songs, which is easier to accomplish. So
yeah, I do that rarely as well.
I know.
Okay. Yeah, I brought quotes. I don't know if we had him yet in the list of big tech guru guys, but this time Steve Jobs, who, even though he's a tech or he was a tech entrepreneur, was also a very good storyteller, because I think he was the one who brought story into corporate presentations and really changed this game of presenting a new product. He says the most powerful person in the world is the storyteller. The storyteller sets the vision, values, and agenda of an entire generation that is to come. And this is very prophetic in a way. I mean, we talked in the revolution episode about the revolutionary power of the iPhone. And I think this is exactly it. Without a story, there probably wouldn't have been an iPhone and it wouldn't have been so successful.
Very convincing. And also he told nonverbal stories. If I remember correctly, when he presented the very first iPhone, he just held it in the air and in a sense like, look, there are no buttons anymore. So this was a birth of the cell phone back then, and he didn't even need words for it, right?
And funny story, also it changed again the sign language. So the younger generation, so we're still holding, you know, the thumb and the little finger up when we try to say we're on the phone. And I think from Gen Z downwards, people just hold up the whole hand because
right.
You have a smartphone, not this old version of a telephone that you're showing. So
yeah, absolutely. So, of course, we want to narrow the storytelling aspect and the communications aspect to science communication. And there's no doubt that there are zillions of challenges right now in the sense of complex versus understandable. And I think that especially in Europe versus the US, for instance, the message has yet to be delivered in a sense, because a lot of people really rely on and trust in their numbers and their data and all that comes with it and think, okay, hey, you've got the data and come on, you got to understand this, but that's just not true, is it?
No, it's not. I think when we talk about science communication, we also have to think about to whom and with which media we communicate. Because, of course, if scientists talk to each other via scientific publications, there is a certain limit of how much story you can put in there. You can still, and I think we'll get to that later, infuse a little bit of story there. But there, of course, it's really hard facts at the center, because it's basically you want to communicate your findings to other scientists so they can either corroborate or refute them. Right. And this is the way science works. And I think it works pretty well despite publishing and everything being quite challenging. But there's, of course, also another aspect, and this is to talk about your science and to write about your science to lay people, which I think is very important. And we learned that, especially during the pandemic, because everyone needs to understand science, even though it might be, as you say, hard to digest and hard to understand. And there are numbers and facts and charts and standard deviations and exponential increase of something is not the easiest thing to understand. But I also think that this element of telling a good story about science that is important when you talk to lay people can also be really helpful if you talk to other scientists in a slightly less formal fashion, for example, during a presentation, or if you write like a commentary perspective, whatever, you have the chance to put your science into perspective. And I think this is really important because also other scientists like to be told stories.
Right, of course, yeah. And I mean, you mentioned the pandemic where it comes to speaking to the civil society, but also there's one branch where you can say you need to talk to governing bodies as well. You need to talk to regulatory bodies, and they got to understand what you're up to. So you've got to do some translation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, like governing and regulatory bodies, and also the people who give you the money.
Yeah, absolutely, of course.
Investors, or if you're in academia, the grant providing bodies, all of them, I mean, they need to be enthralled by your story to hand you over money. And in science, it's a little bit trickier, I think, than in other disciplines, because you have the room to maneuver is not as great, because you need to still stay grounded in the facts. But I think you still have a lot of room to maneuver by using storytelling devices. And I think this has great power to increase the impact and to increase also the understandability of what you're doing.
Scientists, I'm a non-scientist, therefore I can say that, shy away from getting emotional. And story comes with, at least in my understanding, with emotion, right?
Yeah, I think story is almost pure emotion. Story is about a plot, if we think about a novel now. So story, of course, has what I think many people would consider the story, the stuff that happens to people. But in the end, the story is more about the people whom it happens to and what changes in them internally. I took a lot of writing classes for my unpublished novels. And it took me a long time to understand that, because there are so many devices on how to tell stories, and you can read 100 books on novel writing and they will all tell you this is the only method you need. On page 25, this needs to happen, and on page 50.
Lots of profits.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a little bit formulaic the way these stories are told, but if you learn these devices and you look at a Hollywood movie, you can say exactly, and I do that and my husband laughs because I tell him, oh, we're at minute 90 and I can tell you that exactly this must happen now. And this will happen, because there is like a formula to telling stories that simply works. And especially for shorter formats, for movies, it's used a lot. I think the important part is that stories appeal not so much to the brain, but more to the heart, which, I mean, in the end, is the brain, biologically speaking. But it appeals more to our emotions than it appeals to our cognitive thinking. This is what draws us into a story. We're not reading a story and think like, oh, this is so logical, that's amazing. Like, I don't know, if you read Kant or something, you're not like, oh, I need to spend my whole night reading this super rational piece of text. But if you start watching Breaking Bad, you think like, oh, somehow I need to continue watching this. And this is because of the emotive part of the story. And this is something we can translate at least in part also to science. And I think here the question is, what arouses this emotion when we listen to stories or when we read stories or consume stories in any other way? And I think it's really this aspect of not stuff happening, but stuff happening to people I care about. So you need to have some kind of main character or a hero in your story that something happens to that you care about. Yeah. In most parts, if you tell a story in science, that could be just the scientists themselves. And I think here you have enormous potential, because if you tell the story to other scientists, they will know the struggle. If you're in academia, you have usually a lot of struggle with experiments not working, with grants not coming through, with papers not being published, with conflict with other research groups or within the research group. You have a lot of internal and external conflict you can draw upon. Of course, you cannot write that into your publication, like instead of the introduction and write like, I am struggling a lot. This is not possible. But if you, for example, write or present in front of a scientific audience, I think drawing upon that just a little bit, yeah, using a little bit of this struggle that other people will know, maybe in a little fun way. And I think I remember that the presentations that resonate the most are the ones where the presenter makes themselves a little bit human. Not too much. I think then it loses credibility. But having this element of I'm actually a human being who's doing research and who's struggling with it, maybe just a little bit, I think this resonates a lot with the audience.
When it comes to drug discovery, for instance, I think it's a low-hanging fruit to tell a story, because I can, as a scientist, present myself and say, hey, I'm starting out to cure cancer or a certain form of cancer, and I have a personal story to share about this, about a patient who's been saved, say, or, you know, something like that. So it's a lot easier than, you know, when it comes to pure IT or something more technical, because in the field of the biorevolution, always humans are involved, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I think so here we have, of course, this element of the high stakes, which again are very important in storytelling. So something must be at stake. And if we're talking about drug discovery, for example, we have the well-being, the lives of patients at stake. This is kind of obvious, but it can also be overused a little bit. So when in the 2010s, everyone was writing into their grants, now we're going to cure cancer with this discovery. And then somewhere around 2020, everyone was starting to write, we're going to cure COVID with our discovery. It can be a little bit overused and not specific enough. But as you say, if you have a specific patient or if you have a specific form of cancer and you have some kind of backstory behind it, because that's the other big thing about story, the character of your story, and that can be the scientists themselves, that can be a patient, but it can also be maybe metaphorically more the discovery itself that right. could be the hero of the story. But this does not come as a blank slate. Doesn't like appear out of nowhere fully formed. There's always a backstory. And the backstory is what motivates the whole story. It's the why behind the story. And this is really important to have a little bit of an element of this why, of this where am I coming from and why do I actually care about that, or why should you also care about that? And that is really important to round up your story in an emotional fashion. So it's not you're being thrown into something and you don't know why you should care, but you have a little bit of an element. This is the meaning behind it. And as you say, I mean, for anything that brings new medicines, it's very clear why you should care. Absolutely. But there's also many other discoveries. I mean, there's a lot of basic science where it might take a little bit longer to understand why you should care. But we have these stories of, for example, the mRNA therapeutics, where it took ages to bring them to the market and was very basic research of tinkering with nucleotides to make and tinkering with liquid nanoparticles to make them stable in the body. And initially, this story sounds like it's very hard to tell. But if you, for example, tell the story of Katalin Karinko about the adversity, about sticking with your discovery for a long time or with your research for a long time, even though you don't get a lot of recognition, you don't get a lot of funding, and then you win the Nobel Prize for contributing to overcoming one of the biggest pandemics or the biggest pandemic of our recent history, because your discovery was one of the basic factors for the vaccine. A good story.
Well, yes, it is. I would like to stick our pinkies a little bit into one very fascinating fact. I truly believe that there's been a guy who lived like 2,300, I believe, years ago in ancient Greece. And he, like, magically had the deepest possible understanding of good speaking and creating drama, thus telling stories. I personally believe we had the story about the Hollywood movies or good novels and so forth. And I think almost every piece that is touching us and making us change in a way refers to this ancient Greek man with the white beard as he's portrayed. We don't really know how he looked like, but I think we should write about him probably, right?
We're talking about
the storyteller.
Pythagoras and the triangles, right?
No, not Hippocrates.
Aristotle. Yeah, of course. I mean, this idea of balancing information with emotion, so this idea of ethos, pathos, and logos that work together.
In his very famous work, Rhetoric.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think the interesting part of this, he has on the one hand what we discussed now, introduce emotion. And on the other hand, he has this three-act structure of having a structure to a story. So something happens, some call to action, some adversity that has to be overcome. Then this adversity is overcome by the hero. And then we go into the resolution that can be positive or negative. And there are many different devices to that, that hero's journey, save the cat, many yeah. of that. That was the ones that I talked about that I learned a lot about and often had like really a hard time understanding what the event on page 25 should be now. But I think in this very basics that Aristotle lined out a very, very long time ago and that are picked up in any of these storytelling devices is something innate to the way that we process stories in our brains. I think I also recommended this book to you from Lisa Krohn, Story
Genius.
Oh, yes,
you did, and I've got it, and I read it, and I enjoyed it.
It's a really good book that I was recommended by one of my mentors, Liz Jansen. And in this book, the author writes about, and I think, I mean, looking up the sources, I can corroborate that there is an evolutionary power to story. The way we consume stories helps us through evolution to understand, on the one hand, what it means to be human. And that's very helpful for living in groups with other human beings. Because if you haven't noticed, that can be tricky sometimes to... That's true. I mean, it's an evolutionary challenge for humans to live together in a group and not kill each other every morning. So I think in the story is this element of understanding human emotion from a non-self-centered way. But the other part is also to try out situations in a kind of test mode. So dangerous situations that you don't have to put yourself into, but you learn from others who have experienced the chasing the mammoth or being chased by the mammoth or something like that. And I think there is great power in storytelling. And we know that this way we react to story, I mean, we know it from binging TV series the whole night long. I did that when I was in high school. You might remember that. For reading books back then, Ted Williams, where yep. I skipped school because I needed to finish the book. And I have to admit, I'm not employed there anymore. But when I was in my 30s and the new Brandon Sanderson book came out, I also skipped work because I needed to finish this book. I couldn't.
I'm also, you're in a safe space now yep. to say that exactly. because it's so long ago.
No. So, but I think many people know that. Maybe depends a little bit on the medium that you consume. If it's now a big fantasy novel, I also read other stuff, but this is like what keeps me up at night sometimes. Or if you binge a series, or if you, I mean, there's stuff you can't put down. And this is really the power of story. It makes you kind of addicted.
Yes.
And there is something happening in our brains, and it reacts to the story that is told in exactly that way about people and adversity that they have to overcome in a structured way. Mm-hmm. And if you have people who experiment with this, if you have like James Joyce, who is considered one of the best writers of all times, but I think no one has ever read the books. Maybe there must be people who have read them, but they are braver than me because I find it undigestible because it's too complex. And I think, again, going back to science, having a structure to your story, to your presentation, and also to your scientific papers is really important, because I think here having this simple three-act structure, sometimes maybe also some more of these classic events, signposts, you can call them, to tell your story, to have a rising action, having a falling action, this can be really helpful because it's just it speaks to the way we like to consume stories. And we don't do that consciously unless, like me, you read a lot of books about it. And then you start in movies pointing out, now this has to happen because I know that this is the midpoint.
So movies get boring at a certain point.
Not really, but it's not so nice to have this meta-analysis. Yeah. A good story is a story where you don't think about that you're being told a story, but you think you're in the story. And again, for science, of course, it's a little bit trickier than for fictional writing or storytelling, but it's still possible to immerse people in your story. And you, I think everyone will have seen presentations where exactly that happens, where you're in the role of the scientist going through this amazing discovery process and you're super into it and excited about it. And this is something that you can evoke. And I think with many different types of research, so it doesn't have to be the grand stakes. It doesn't always have to be, we will cure cancer tomorrow and here is patient 1, 2, 3. And I was also struggling with adversity 1, 2, 3. I think being authentic and being specific is very important when we're telling stories.
Yeah. So this is a one piece that has been delivered from ancient Greece to us, which is still, I think, really, really amazing. The other piece, it's not the drama, but it's the rhetoric that you refer to as well, with the logos, ethos, pathos. And there's been the famous Mehrabian study in the 1960s that has been falsified many times. But there's another author that we both like, who wrote a book like Chalk Like Ted, Carmine Gallo. I would really encourage you to read this, not you, Izzy, but our audience, because it's really a fun read and it's also shows some evidence. So he had this Aristotle triangle and put it in line with the most famous TED Talks. What came out?
I think, what was it, 65% pathos we need, right? This is like a strong focus on emotion.
It is. And I mean, if I do coachings, if I have panel discussions that I have to moderate or something, I always see that, especially in Germany or in Europe, you get to maybe 10% of pathos. So it's way, way under this. And I always advise people, well, lean out of the window as far as you feel comfortable creating pathos in what you're delivering. And if you make it to 30%, fine, that's a good starting point. So this is again where the line meets that you mentioned of staying authentic on the one hand, on the other hand, creating a little more pathos, and with it naturally comes storytelling, of course.
And I think here we really need to think, because for me, learning this, so I thought I could just innately tell stories. Mm. And I think to an extent I can, but I think there are many devices that can help you making the story better. And I think it's kind of a checklist. So think about, do I have any human element and does that recur? Because I think this is really important to think about, do I have any element of my presentation, of my writing that people can care about? Could be me, it could be the story of a patient or of someone who is affected by something, for example, climate change or something else. And it could also be the discovery itself if it's told in a specific and good way. Here, I think we have some devices that really help us care more about discoveries, which is putting pictures to it, making them human digestible. So having, for example, the story of the double helix discovery. This is such a strong story because the double helix is such a strong image, because it's a staircase and because you have the image of the two guys sitting in the pub and looking at this double helix. And by the way, this is also a story that can be reframed with the two of them becoming the villains of the story, stealing actually the discovery from Rosalind Franklin by revisiting the way science is viewed. But I think it's having imagery, having specificity to your story. This gives emotion, this gives pathos, because I think anything that is general will not speak to your audience. But it's sometimes not so easy to keep that in mind. So I think having this checklist of, do I have something to care about, people or discoveries? And am I specific enough? Am I telling my story, the patient's story, the specific story of the discovery without being too general? And I think this is a very important factor for increasing the amount of pathos in the story. And I think there is another thing that should come kind of at the beginning of storytelling, but for me often comes at the end. And this is the bigger picture, the big why. We talked about it, the home alone.
The home alone, yes.
This is, like, one could say, the theme, the motto, the overall device behind the story you're telling. And this must include both pathos and logos, I think. There's like a cognitive thing that you're trying to address or that you're trying to solve, but there's an emotional quality to it, and it should be specific. And if you have that, and if you can think about that in every paragraph you write or in every slide you present, and maybe even include it here and there. So I think repetition is a device that works really well, especially if you're giving a talk. You can say the same thing many, many times. People won't actually be frustrated if you have this key message for yourself. And I think it would be really great if you had that at the beginning. But for me, often I need to prepare a whole talk or write a whole thing before I know what the key message is, because it changes for me a little bit. I think from other people, it depends on the way you're thinking. It might be that you actually start with that and then you can write around it.
Yeah, but it's inductive or deductive methods in creating speeches, yeah, or presentations, of course. Yeah.
But having that, and I think this is really what gets it to the next level, knowing what you're really talking about.
Yeah, for me, the image with the Home Alone, which of course refers to the famous movie of Kevin, and I always tried to tell the story like, imagine you'll be pitching a Hollywood movie and there's the cigar-smoking owner of the studio and he doesn't really care about you, and you've got not even an elevator pitch, but a lot less than that. Come up with, my idea is Home Alone. And the fascinating thing about that is that it tells the story in two words of a 90-minute Hollywood movie. And to me, I always challenge people to say, okay, imagine I wake you up at 3 a.m. in the middle of the night and ask you, what is your talk going to be about? Then you have to come up with this one sentence and you have to be convinced of it. And at that point where you can do that, you're good to go. Nothing bad can happen to you if you have this self-assurance. And I sometimes think that with the overwhelming amount of numbers, especially in the scientific community, this self-assurance is somewhat lacking oftentimes.
Yeah, or we're really stuck to the presentation of numbers.
Yeah.
And I think this is also important, of course, but I think we should see the numbers as a part of the story. So they're a helpful device, but not the story themselves. They're the fuel for the story, but they're not the story.
Ira Glass, the founder and I would even go so far to say the kind of inventor of podcasts and the host of This American Life, which is, I think, the longest running show on planet Earth. He always says, because of course by now he's a instructor in podcasting as well, and he always says you have to zoom in and have to find this character that is suffering, the hero's journey, but then you have to have the bigger picture. Why should anybody be interested in what I have to deliver? And you always have to have this bigger picture. And this, of course, can be the Home Alone, curing cancer, inventing or finding the cure for a pandemic. If you have this tool set in your brain, you're good to go, right?
Yeah, but I also want to emphasize that good writing and good storytelling is a lot of work, at least for me.
Yes.
And I think some people have this, it just pours out of them and they're perfect at it. But I think if you, again, this is also very nice in the Talk Like TED book, how much he emphasizes it's just a lot of work. It's, you have to put in the effort, because I think we're told these stories that especially writing should come naturally and just flow out of you and we get these stories, these examples of people who are 22 and they sit down and they write a whole book in one sitting with a pen. But for most people, it's not like that.
And Jack Kerouac phenomenon.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. On the road.
So I think putting in the work is worth it, but it can feel counterintuitive because it feels like it should be something that we're, I think for many people, investing in story feels like a waste of time. You cannot tell your story, especially if it's not your very specific target audience. So if it's anyone who is a little bit beyond, I think you need storytelling devices to capture the attention and to provide the impact. And I think most discoveries have impact. Whatever you're doing in science, it's impactful, even though in the daily business, it might not feel like it. And telling the story can also be a psychologically helpful thing to take a step back, think about your home alone, and think about your backstory. Why do I care? Why should someone else care? And it can actually infuse also meaning into something that in daily life, I think for many of the things that we're doing, it's sometimes a little bit drudgery. But thinking and talking about it in this more bigger picture, meaningful way can also be helpful to infuse the meaning for yourself. So I think it's really worth it to invest in it. And I think for me, the biggest advice would be to stay authentic, use these devices, but also use them as a helpful tool, fit for purpose and not as the means to an end. So it should not be the meaning in itself, right? So it should be something that can help you get your story across.
Izzy, wrapping it up, I have one more thing I really would like to know a little bit more. I mean, you referred to it quite a bit already, but the distinction, because in my place, I'm at the crossroads where it comes to translating science into a meaningful conversation for the civil society, for politicians, for people who are in economics and stuff like that. But when you are moving inside the scientific community, so you hinted to that at the very beginning of the show, do I have to imagine that you just reduce the amount of pathos a little bit when you talk from scientist to scientist? Or is it something where you would stress the logos a little bit more, or where you would infuse less drama, or where you would let the numbers speak more than the story of a patient or stuff like that? So what is the distinction of the two ways of communicating?
Yeah, I think it also depends a little bit on the forum in which you're speaking. So if you're, for example, having like a keynote at a big conference, you might talk in a
recently,
different...
You recently talked to like 300 fellow scientists. What is the difference at that point talking to this bunch of people opposing talking to, well, just a crowd?
Yeah, so I would say tone down the pathos a little bit for it, because I think scientists also don't like things to be too flashy. This is really important. At the same time, I think you still have the devices. So I think first of all, having the structure of the story, this is super important. Having the human element, at least in the beginning and in the end, you don't have to show the human element while you're showing data graphs. And then while you're presenting the data, think about very hard every time, how does this piece of data tell my story? If it doesn't tell my story, maybe this is not the right piece of data to show. Not saying, of course, that, I mean, if it's negative data, then so not leaving out important pieces of data in order to tell your story. I mean, the data should lead your story, of course. So first think about, can I corroborate the story that I want to tell with my data, but then select the pieces of data that speak the strongest. That's what I'm trying to say. And then I think having these little devices that induce emotion on every slide, having elements like, for example, a little bit of humanity showing through. If you present like data, you can say how much time it took you or your team to actually create that. Maybe also show, if you're like the PI, show the pictures of the people who, or in any case, show the images of your colleagues who helped you work on that, for example. That already gives a little bit of human touch to it. And I think an important element are telling details. Having details that tell the story by themselves. And that can, for example, be pictures of a piece of machinery or of this one important image. I just had this example of Watson and Crick with the double helix. But we also now have this image of the radiographic image that Rosalind Franklin took. And you, if you put these two pictures next to one another, you have the full story.
And that's amazing. Yes.
And these are telling details. These are really used massively in movies to tell a story. If someone saw Brokeback Mountain, there is at the end this scene where he takes the shirt out of the cabinet after the other guy died. And this is really like, this picture tells the whole story and the theme. And I think you will find, because if one does research for a long time, there will be these telling details. And these are really good for inducing the emotion into the story and for also telling the story. Using metaphors is really important, or similes. So creating imagery that makes the story understandable. And I think especially for any complex scientific things, if you don't have good metaphors, you're losing big parts of the audience, even if it's a scientific audience. And if that's something for you, having an element of humor can really be helpful. But this should be natural again. And for any of these things, being authentic is the most important part of it. And I think you can be authentic in many different ways. I'm, for example, a relatively introvert person by nature, and I don't become Steve Jobs when I go on stage, but I still manage to speak to people. And I think there's different ways to be yourself and speak to people that work. And I would really emphasize that, not to practice, for example, things that don't feel natural, but more think, what is it that I have in myself that fits the theme of the story, that fits my story, that allows me to tell it in a proper way?
I think story is a golden bullet for speakers, and therefore I guess we both would like to encourage anybody who listens to our show today just to try it and just to be courageous going out there and kind of reduce numbers and increase story for the better of your keynote or your speech or your presentation, right? So that's really something you might want to think about. And I found it very good that you mentioned at the end that by nature, you're more an introvert than somebody who just goes out in the center of the party and everything. And you can practice in front of mirrors, in front of your family, in front of your spouse, partner, whatever it is, and try it out. And this can be a steep journey, and it can be a lot of effort to get there. But I guess we both agree it's worthwhile.
For me, absolutely.
Closing up, do we have ideas? Where are we going with We're Doomed, We're Saved? Tell us a story.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to say quickly that I think we'll put the sources that we referred to also
in the
show notes, the books, because they're both really worth reading.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
James Joyce, Ulysses, I think also.
Maybe there are people out there who prove us wrong and tell us that it's not non-readable.
Exactly. It's a challenge. Yeah, I would, for our Christmas episode, which will be the next one already, like to talk about something that I encounter in my daily life, which is stress. Not Christmas stress, but like just being a human and working and juggling life somehow seems to me, and I think to many other people, a little bit stressful. And there is a lot of thoughts out about science of cortisol and other things that are especially prevalent in social media right now. So I would like to take a deeper look at that and see, yeah, what we can get out of that and maybe use that as a nice primer for the next year to think about.
And we might even find ways to cure stress without drugs.
Or
recommend ways to do so.
I would hope so, but let's have a look what we find.
Next time in We're Doomed, We're Saved, many thanks, Easy. I think this was one very enlightening to really dig into science communication. So this was We're Doomed, We're Saved, and very many thanks for listening. Further information at
sciencetales.com.
Thank you, Easy.
Thank you.